When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price. This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beat your price. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beat your price.
The other rights remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have a right to an attorney prior to or during any question. If you can't afford one, the court will appoint one for you. Do you understand your rights?
When the wolf is at your door, you run in zone, but that's for sure.
This episode of Real Life, Real Crime, the podcast may contain descriptions of acts of violence or that of a sexual nature and should be for people that are 18 years or older. Heed my warning, people. I do not get the facts of these cases off of the internet or from some television show. The facts I'm retelling you were presented to me by the victims of the crimes or the perpetrators who committed the crimes against the victims. My descriptions of the crime scenes, what I saw with my own two eyes. If you're going to get offended, please turn this podcast off now. Thank you. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Real Life, Real Crime, the podcast. As always, I'm your host, Woody Overton. Y'all, we're definitely going to be continuing the state versus Scott Peterson today, and we're in the heart of the jury selection of voir dire, and it's very important that you hear about this because what happens ultimately in the case, a lot of it is going to be with the jurors, is very scorched. But y'all check out my TikTok. It's under Real Life, Real Crime. Now, if somebody is knocking me off, it has my emblem, it has my name, but it's not me. But you can tell the difference when you see them. And so y'all check that out. I'm doing a lot of cooking videos and funny videos and stuff like that. And we're going to have really cool products some people have been sending us. So just check it out. And we'll have links to the products in the descriptions. And I love and appreciate each and every one of y'all. And let's get into it. All right. So when I left you last, I told you that the 12 jurors and the four alternates had been picked and who they were and what I thought about the picks, which are crazy as fuck. Ultimately, because they had another 600-something people they could have gone through, and I got, you know, an ex-cop and firefighters and paramedics and social worker that worked with abused children and all these things that you would think would be so, well, I guess they might have been scorched against Peterson and vice versa. But it is what it is. The process is what it is. And they said after the selection, according to Varsinsky, it seemed the jurors were chosen more on the grounds of their upstanding moral character than basically how they answer, right? And the jurors' ability to process the evidence and make logical, responsible decisions regarding Peterson's guilt superseded any interests or experiences that would at first glance indicate potential bias for or against Peterson. And that's what I told you about in the last episode. And y'all, if you haven't listened to other episodes, go back and listen to them, because this is all, it's like building blocks, right? It's all building on top of each other. But during the whole judicial process, the jurors never knew each other's names. They didn't know what their real names were. And I guess that's to keep them from contacting each other or what have you. You know, I don't know. But the court told them to say, hey, look, we want y'all to choose a different name to go by. And write that name down. And this is what you call each other. If your name is really John Smith, you know, you pick Joe Blow and you tell everybody your name's Joe Blow, and that's what you'll be known as, right? And this would preserve their anonymity throughout the trial. Now, the jurors had to pick their aliases on the spot, and they all had different meanings behind their aliases, meaning like how the judge told them, do this now, and, you know, I guess when you think what your name's going to be in your head, you tie it back to something, right? So Greg Bartolus, juror number one, became Zane. And he joked that he picked that because this was insane, right? And Tom Marino, juror number two, became Mario. I guess it's something easy for him to remember. And Lorena Gonzalez, juror number three, she chose Crystal. And Mike Bell Messeri, juror number four, was Treadhead. And that's a reference to him being a Marine tank commander. Pretty cool. Justin Falconer, juror number five, was Kikoa, which is a reference to his years of living in Hawaii. And then you had juror number six, Steve Cardosi, and he chose Cap because of his aspirations to become a fire captain. Interesting. It is pretty cool to see what these people, you know, real people think about themselves, I guess. But juror number seven, Frances Gorman, nicknamed herself Leilani. And juror number eight, Gunasio, chose Bill because of his fear of bills piling up if the jury needed to sequester, right? You can't go home. You can't do anything. You can't pay your bills. That's pretty cool. Julie Zanartu, juror number nine, she chose the nickname Joe, a genderless, generic name that would identify as little about herself as possible. Very sensible. So Mary Mallette, juror number 10, chose the name Sean, the name of her deceased son. And we'll get back to that later. And then juror number 11, Ferry Sorrell, became Tracy. And then juror number 12, Christy Lamore, became Juliet, right? Well, and then we got the alternates, y'all. The alternates, alternate number one, Greg Jackson, chose the nickname D-Day, because he was reading about the Allied landings at Normandy during World War II. And Rochelle Nice, who was alternate number two, chose Reese. And Nice would later be nicknamed by the media as Strawberry Shortcake because of her bright red hair. And alternate number three, Dennis Lear, chose Montera, the name of the town where he lived at the beginning of the trial. And alternate number four, Debbie Germanos, chose the nickname Shannon. I mean, you know, I probably would have chose mine, fucking forgot it. But alternate number five, Sharon McNeil, chose Jazz. And then alternate number six, Michael Church, chose Neo, the character from The Matrix, right? Matrix, the what's his name? I love that dude. Played in the original Point Blank. Anyway, the Matrix movies. But so when they're in the courtroom, the judge instructs them, you know, you have this, how you have to act, right? When you're hearing shit during the trial, blah, blah, blah. And this is what you can and can't do. So jurors were not allowed to make any gestures or facial expressions or verbalize to anyone in the courtroom. Okay, so imagine that. I mean, that doesn't ever really happen because anytime you show dead body pictures and stuff like that, you're going to have facial expressions, okay? They were not allowed to talk about the trial to anyone, including each other. And this is going to be a scorch part coming up. Stay with me. And they were not sequestered for the trial, meaning they could go home after every day in court. Now, y'all, I don't know how you get away with that other than they're figuring if they got to house them for 6 months in a hotel, they've got to feed them 3 meals a day. They have to provide 24-hour security for the jury even when they're in court and then when they're in the hotel. And there's probably going to be a couple officers. I guess they did it on the idea that it would be easier if they just go home and make the promise that they wouldn't talk about or watch anything. Jurors were paid once a month for their service. And guess how much they got, y'all? This is why nobody wants to be on jury duty. They got $15 a day. So if you do that, that's $150, $300. They're making like $400 a month, y'all, to sit on the jury. They also gave them $10 for travel one way, right? And then they sent them home. After the voir dire is selected, everybody's ready to go to trial. They were told to go home and report back to court on June the 1st for the first day of the trial. All right. Now, getting into the trial, let's roll with it. So the big day comes, June 1st, 2004, and the trial begins, right? So they would stand up and they say, we here in the matter of the state of California versus Scott Peterson for the homicides and all the charges I wrote y'all, et cetera. And that's what the trial was. So, and again, it was in Redwood City. Now, Redwood City, that's where it got moved to. And Redwood City is like a quiet, small area. It's not the hustle and bustle of San Francisco or LA or anywhere else, but you wouldn't have known it on the first day of trial because there were media trucks with the big satellites on them parked everywhere. There was no parking. There were media vehicles. There were spectator vehicles. The people set up tents, y'all, and the whole courthouse was surrounded, all right? And the reporters and the jurors and family members of Scott Peterson and Lacey's family members and their friends and everybody, they all have to go through the metal detectors before entering the courtroom. And when that happens, you're in a funnel, right? You got to walk to the door through all the media. They would have had a lane cut out, but they're like, this is it. This is the big time, right? But you don't want to go to court and have to answer questions from the media. Now, security around the trial is like any trial now. You get to the courthouse, and look, the last murder trial I did, I was there every day for weeks, and every day I get to the same thing, get to the funnel, and you're mixed in that with the people that you're going up against, their family members and stuff, and everybody's just in line. You got to get in the courthouse by a certain time. You have to allow time to go through security. And it's like going through TSA at the airport. Everything out of your pockets, walk through the thing, searching your shit, pull you to the side if they think they need to. And this is what these people had to go through for almost 6 months, every day. And I mean, I guess that's not scorch. I believe in that because all the idiots in the world now and people try to kill you. So, the first day of the trial, Judge DeLucci's courtroom is packed to capacity, overflowing. Everybody can't get in, right? And as is to be expected. But the courtroom held about 150 people, and it's split down the middle. There's aisles on both sides. I call them pews, basically. But you have the aisle, and you have the long pews and seats on both sides, and that bitch is full to the brim, and there's a deputy standing on the outside of the door telling people that they can't come in, right? So As is typical in any trial, including the last one I did, the victim's family sits on one side of the courtroom, usually in the front, on the front row, and they would have had a victim's advocate that would have taken care of them and stuff like that in case they had any questions or whatever. And then on the other side of the courtroom is the bad guy, in this case, the accused, Scott Peterson's family. All right. They sit on opposite sides of the courtroom. And the, you know, certainly this is a circumstantial case, meaning evidence wise. And people think that circumstantial is a bullshit case. Exactly the opposite, y'all. And I'm going to read you a little bit, but then I'll tell you about it. So in the context of the Peterson case, Peterson's affair with Amber Fry is circumstantial evidence, right? It's not direct evidence that Peterson killed Lacey, but it raised enough suspicion that it may help the prosecution get a conviction. And even though the affair is circumstantial evidence, it's powerful because any reasonable person or fairly reasonable person would assume that an innocent man whose pregnant wife was missing would not be having an affair. Fair enough, close enough to that, right? Certainly he would have called her cell phone and stuff like that. Now, the prosecution, everything escorts, I already told you. The prosecution and the defense's opening statements, and as well as the trial itself, were all based on circumstantial evidence. They did not have any direct evidence is either circumstantial or direct, right? And in circumstantial meaning, like if I'm getting ready to go take a nap and I see it's clouded up, it's black, the wind's blowing hard, and it looks like it's about to rain, and I go take my nap and I come out and everything's soaked, right? And the trees are blown down and whatever. Well, a reasonable person would assume that it rained, right? You didn't see it rain. Well, that's circumstantial evidence. Now, the direct evidence would be, had I actually seen the rain and the wind blow the trees down, then I could testify to direct that I actually saw this. Well, they didn't have that in this case, okay? Nobody actually saw Scott Peterson with Lacey's body. All right, let's go to opening statements. Now, as always, the trial begins, the prosecution gets to get up and give their part of the open statements. Okay. And then the defense gets to give theirs, and there you have it. And y'all know this. Gargos and the prosecutor, Rick D'Estacio, were polar opposites in their opening statements. And this is important. This is fucking scorched, and we'll get to it in a minute. Where Gargos was flamboyant, and he's wearing designer suits, and he's strolling around all confident, full of himself, like the cock of the walk, right? And on the other side, D'Estacio was more subtle, and they'd said he sometimes seemed unsure of himself. And as one of the jurors, Rochelle Neese, described them, she said, "I just looked at it like this big Hollywood attorney versus this little Modesto County bumpkin." She's talking about the prosecutor, y'all. Now, Gargos' opening statement was fucking badass, okay? It held everybody's attention, and it captivated them. And the jurors were like, "Holy shit, you know, he's promising all this. Holy shit. This dude's badass." Right. But then D'Estacio's opening statement, they didn't feel it really had the mojo that, Gargos did. Right. So according to the jurors, D'Estacio sometime talked abstractly, and it would take him a while to make a point. So maybe not very well versed in handling the high profile stuff and knowing that he's playing to a juror, but certainly the best that Mateo had to offer. But the D'Estacio's opening statement took all day long, y'all. They rambled on and on and on and on. Well, that's not what you really want to do with a jury. You want to grab a hold of their attention, make them like you. You know what I mean? You want to fucking shock and awe them if you need to, whatever you got to do. That you never get a second chance to make a first impression. But regardless of that, he did it. And then Gergos gets up and he wows him and dows him. And guess what? His took not even the whole morning, right? He just did enough for them to say, holy fuck, look at this cat, right? He's got it going on. So, and y'all, during the opening statements, you're not, as a prosecutor, you're not allowed really to present an argument, you know, going against what they're saying during the opening statements, but you're only allowed to recite the facts. Hey, y'all, changing my wardrobe from summer to fall. Hey, it's never easy. Luckily, Quince offers timeless and high quality items I adore, ensuring my wardrobe stays fresh and I don't blow my budget. And there's nothing easier than going to Quince and choosing these high quality items, like cashmere sweaters from $50, pants for every occasion, washable silk tops, and so much more. The best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes, and I love that. Look, I got the stainless steel Link Apple Watch band for $59.90, and it's heavy duty, it's awesome, and it's like $100 less than I could find anywhere else. And I also got 100% organic cotton fisherman quarter zip up sweater. The color is alabaster. Man, I can't wait to wear that dude out this fall. And Cindy got the Mongolian cashmere boat neck sweater in heather gray, and I'm tell you, these are classic pieces at a fraction of the price. Make switching seasons a breeze with Quince's high quality closet essentials. Go to quince.com/RLRC for free shipping on your order and 365 day returns. That's quince.com/RLRC to get free shipping and 365 day returns. Quince.com/RLRC. You'll thank me later. Do you want to set your child up for success? Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with a subject? Is your child ahead, not getting challenged enough in class? IXL Learning is an online learning program that enriches your homeschool curriculum. It offers practice in math, English, language arts, science, and social studies while adapting to each child, meeting them where they are. Plus, IXL encourages students to be curious and empowers them how to choose to learn. Now, Cindy used IXL in the classroom as a teacher and now uses it to homeschool our youngest son in the 9th grade. The videos are what she finds that benefits him most in math because he's a very visual learner. The perfect supplement to your homeschool curriculum, IXL offers interactive practice problems, educational game lessons, and video tutorials for every topic you're teaching at home. It's easy to use, time-saving, and everything on IXL is organized by grade, subject, topic, and subtopic, making it simple to find activities for the exact skills you're covering. Instant grading, helpful progress reporting. IXL offers instant feedback and explanations of new topics as kids use the program. Flexible and personalized. Kids can explore any topic in any grade level. They aren't forced into a single learning path like they are on other programs. If you're homeschooling your child because they were falling behind or because they were too far ahead, IXL is a great program to help them get the exact support they need. It's fun for kids, and kids love IXL's positive feedback, awards, and educational games. And it's trustworthy. IXL is trusted by 15 million students worldwide and has proven to improve performance in over 75 scientific research studies. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And Real Life Real Crime listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/today. Visit IXL.com/today to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Well, the facts as they knew were that Lacey went missing. Scott saying, you know, he went fishing and his affair. Just, I mean, nothing probably there. Everybody in the jury didn't already know, right? So the dossier opened by describing in great detail the night of December 24th, beginning with Sharon Rocha, Lacey's mom, having her, when she was getting ready for the Christmas Eve family dinner, and then she got the phone call from Scott asking if Lacey is there. Well, Scott never called Lacey. Remember that, Scott? That's Scorch. The Stasio closed this open statement with, "Ladies and gentlemen, this is a common sense case, and I let me thank you right now. I appreciate your attention as I did this opening statement for you. At the end of this case, I'm going to ask you to find the defendant guilty of the murder of his wife, Lacey, as well as his unborn child, Connor Peterson. Thank you." Okay. Well, when the Stasio first mentioned the hair and the pliers, which I'll get into, but which they found in his fishing boat, he said it was Lacey's, y'all, and Gregorios blows up. He ejected to the judge based on another ruling, and an in-camera hearing was held to review the other judge's ruling. Now, what we're talking about in-camera hearing, meaning that outside of the presence of the jury, they went behind closed doors or recorded it, and this, you know, both sides would have got to say why he felt he should be able to, should or shouldn't be able to say that the hair was found, right? And when the Stasio convened this open statement, he informed the jury that he had misspoken and that the hair was ruled out for Scott, but not ruled out for Lacey. Fuck up, Scorched. And if they don't get it now, y'all, they're going to get it on appeal. But so Gregorios begins his opening statement, and he right off the bat, I mean, he said, "Hey, Scott Peterson isn't the fucking saint, you know, and he is not the all-American boy." And he took the Amber Fry situation head on. He admitted to it. He said, "Yep, Scott had an affair with Amber Fry," right? And he said, "Many men have affairs, and just because Scott Peterson is an adulterer doesn't make him a murderer." See, he's trying to take away the fire, y'all. He said the members of the jury may want to call him a cad, but there was no evidence to support Scott's guilt. Now, Gregorios held up a stack of reports from the Modesto police representing reports from searches conducted on Scott's home, truck, and warehouse. He loudly drops the stack of reports on the defense table, basically slams them down, y'all, and he emphasized that the Modesto police were able to find no incriminating evidence against Scott from these searches. He's laying down his work, saying what they scorched, right? Gregorios also claimed that he would prove that Lacey was alive on the morning of December 24th after Scott left to go to his warehouse. Now, that's big shit, right? You gonna prove it? Boy, if you're gonna do that, then he's not guilty. And if he could prove it, jurors would have to acquit Peterson, right? And Gregorios concluded his open statement by saying, "The evidence will show that not only is Scott Peterson not guilty, but Scott Peterson is stone cold innocent, right? Showmanship. And he walks off and sits down. And the trial gets ready to begin. So you got one side, I don't think Modesto is outclassed. I don't know. Maybe they don't have a lot of big murder trials. I don't know. But you could definitely score one for the defense in the opening arguments and the presence of the attorneys, right? So, but I'm going to tell you a little bit more. What the defense is trying to do, they know, you know, everything that's coming down the pipe. You got your discovery. You know what they're going to use, being the prosecution. And so you're going to try to get it out there ahead of time that they focus just on Scott. Then these are alternative things that could happen. Any little thing, all the mud you throw against the wall, hoping one of them sticks in a juror's brain, and you get a not guilty. And in the opening statement by Mark Argos, he said that Lacey knew about the boat. Now, prosecution said that Lacey didn't know about the boat. He said a witness will testify that Lacey was at the warehouse on December 20th and saw the boat, right? And a woman will testify that she talked to Lacey that same day when Lacey used the bathroom next door at the warehouse because of the fertilizer products blocking the bathroom at the warehouse. Okay. Another thing he highlights, he said, Martha Stewart did talk about meringue on the 24th, and Gargos played the segment with noticeable reactions from the spectators. Let me tell you about that. In his initial interview, Scott's in the Modesto Police Department, and they're interviewing about him. What'd y'all do that day? Oh, we woke up and we shared a bowl of cereal because we were too lazy to do whatever. And Lacey was watching Martha Stewart. And they said, well, what was she watching? And I would ask the same thing. And he said, I don't know, something about making a meringue. Well, the fucking prosecution and the police fucked it up. They never checked it. They just assumed that Scott was lying about the meringue. And guess what? Garagos and his defense team, their investigator, they went and looked it up. And then that exact time frame that this would have taken place, Martha Stewart was on TV talking about making the meringue. And so that shocked everybody. They're like, holy fuck, if he's got this right, and he's saying he's going to prove Scott's not a murderer and all this other stuff, you know, it's not looking good for the prosecution. And that's like one of the dumbest things you could do as a prosecutor is fucking miss the fact that in your opening statements and in your arguments, you're going to say he's lying, lying, lying. And he's lying. He even lied about Martha Stewart being on TV. Well, you just disproved it. So they're like, holy fuck. Prosecutor just told us this. He just disproved this. What else is going to be able to disprove? All right. Well, some of the other things he said was that the khaki pants Lacey was found in are not the same pants Lacey wore on the 23rd to Amy's salon. Y'all remember when they went and he promised to get, Peterson promised to pick up the basket for Amy. And also the khaki pants were not the same, pants that Scott had said she was wearing, basically. But when law enforcement obtained a pair of the same pants, they showed them to Amy, and who said they were not the same. The pants Lacey had on did not have a drawstring. The pocket style was different, and the other style features were different. And Amy is going to get up and testify. And what do you do about that, y'all? I mean, it's not looking good. Let's get into the trial. Now, I told you that the report on June the 1st, and you had your opening arguments on both sides. And now, once they're done with that, the judge would say, Mr. Prosecutor, are you ready to proceed, right? And, of course, he's going to say yes. And he'll say, well, then you may call your first witness. Now, again, stick with me. Each one of these, not each one of them, not every one of them, some of them are very, very scorched, and it all comes together in the end. So on Wednesday, June the 2nd, prosecution's first witness was a lady named Margarita Nava, who was a housekeeper, okay? And Rick D'Estacio was the one who asked her the questions, got her to say what she had to say. And then she, of course, she was cross-examined by Mark Garagos. Now, what she did, she described her cleaning routine and Lacey's activities on the morning of the 23rd. She also told the court what Lacey was wearing and her observations of Lacey's general health, meaning she was alive, right? Last time she saw her. And then, you know, it takes a long time and they go through, they break for whatever reason, I guess, because the open arguments carried over. And so we're going to Thursday, June the 3rd, 2004. Prosecution calls as a second witness Fred Ekus, the manager of Trader Joe's. Now, who doesn't love Trader Joe's, right? If you got enough money to go in there and shop. And again, Rick D'Estacio is doing the examination for the prosecution, the direct examination, and Mark Garagos is doing the cross-examination. And this gentleman, Mr. Fred, testified about a purchase that Lacey made at Trader Joe's at 10.06 a.m. on December the 23rd. And on cross-examination, Garagos asked several questions about this challah bread, right, that she purchased. And Ika said, it is a specialty bread that is delivered daily, and it's more popular around the Christmas holidays. Okay. What we're trying to do here, people, the prosecution is trying to establish, it's going to basically establish up to the last person who saw her alive. And they were like, yeah, pretty much ruling out his thoughts of suicide if she's in Trader Joe's buying bread for the holidays. All right. And continuing on Thursday, June 2004, the prosecution's third witness is Miss Tina Maria Michelle Pope Resling, who is a manicurist at Sweet Serenity Day Spa. And again, Rick D'Estacio does the direct examination and Pat Harris does the cross. And Reswig worked at the spa on December 23rd and had an interaction with Lacey. She described Lacey as wearing a white long sleeve top with no buttons or collar and black capri pants, black Mary Jane shoes, and a silver and gold watch. And Lacey told her she was tired. Now, this lady had been interviewed by Detective Grogan in March of 2003. And again, just a few weeks before her testimony. Yeah, that's common, especially in big trials. You go back the week or so before trial and just make sure people are going to say the same shit. And doesn't really matter, neither here nor there. This spa does not have any type of video surveillance or cameras that they could show. All right. Moving on to prosecution witness number four. Again, same Rick is doing the direct, and this time the cross-examination is done by the second chair, Pat Harris, for that works with Garagos. So it's Michelle Boer, who is the owner of the Sweet Serenity Day Spa. She said Lacey kept an appointment with Boer for a facial waxing on December the 23rd. Boer had been interviewed by Brocchini on January 17th, 2003, and Grogan on March 19th, 2003. Buer wasn't sure if Lacey was wearing black capri pants or a skirt and described her top as a colored button-down. Buer was also involved the night of the Christmas Eve opening up dittos so flyers could be made that open up or whatever business they keep flyers to pass out about Lacey. She told Grogan early on that she was uncomfortable discussing Scott with Lacey's friends because she had already formed the opinion on Christmas Day that he was responsible. Now, several times during her testimony, She claimed that what Detective Grogan and Detective Rocchini wrote in the reports is not what she told them. She noted that Lacey, unlike other female clients who talk about their husbands and boyfriends, never said a negative word about Scott. Okay, scorch people. This is, they did their homework, no doubt about it, and they went through these statements, and when they talked to this lady, now the investigators for defense will go out and talk to the key witnesses or people that they know are going to get on, try and find any inconsistencies. Well, she tells them that the police, what they put in the reports is wrong. It's not true. Ooh, there's a first brick in the foundation of a house that's going to burn down and be scorched, or should have. Why? Now, we're going to find out why later on, all right? And, you know, but certainly you score points for for the defense on the fact that she's saying the detectives basically are either stupid and incompetent, or they're lying about what she told them. And she never heard Lacey bitch about Scott. All right. Then we move on to prosecution witness number 5. And the direct examination is by Rick, and cross-examination again by Pat Harris. So this lady is Lori Wessenberg, and she's the manager of the salon, right? And sometime in late January, Chris Johnson, the owner, had placed 2 surveillance tapes on Wessenberg's desk for her to review to see if either of them had footage of Lacey on the 23rd. She concluded that they didn't and put the tapes back into circulation. So when Grogan inquired about the possibility of surveillance footage of Lacey, the tapes had already been taped over, and Modesto PD let it go at that. Now, Wessenberg noted that since Lacey was not a paying customer because she was family, remember that, she would not have gone to the front counter and thus would not likely have been captured on surveillance video. Back it up. Another brick. Okay. The tapes have been brought forward, and somebody looks at them and says, I don't think they're relevant. And when they put it back in circulation, y'all, like if most places, it used to be back in the day, I think it's different now because of the cloud and all that shit. When you go in and you pull the surveillance tapes, most of them re-loop over on the 29th day, meaning that they record over everything that was on them before. That's why the surveillance is often grainy. The old surveillance is often grainy and shitty looking because it's been recorded over and over and over again. And Modesto PD is like, fuck it. I understand they got a lot of shit going on and you're going to hear about all of it, but this is another brick for the prosecution to say and do their fucking job. And all you had to do is go look at the tapes, and then write a report that says she's not on them. And this wouldn't even be a brick for them. Okay. All right. Moving on. Prosecution witness number 6, Christopher Johnson. I just mentioned, who is the owner of Salon, and direct examination is done by Rick D'Estacio, and this time Mark Garagus does the cross-examination. Now, Johnson gets on the stand, and he says he remembers Salon having at least a 14-day cycle of surveillance tapes, meaning, y'all, that they automatically started recording after 14 days, where most of them, I'd never slept. Seen one at 14 days. Most of them at 30 days, but neither here nor there. He also mentioned a digital recording system, but said the Modesto PD never asked to see it. To a person sitting on the jury, that'd be a big deal. To me, it's not really a big deal because this is the day before she went missing, right? And people saw her after this. But continuing, he recalled Lacey wearing a dark top and light color pants that contrasted with the black couch he saw her sitting on. And he didn't recall a date. He talked to Detective Grogan, but the prosecutor D'Estacio produced a report dated January the 17th. And Modesto PD also inquired about Amy's time cards and her inheritance. I don't know why you would do that to this guy. Maybe that I mean, he's asked his family, I guess. I don't know. But again, a lot of what we're doing here, the prosecution is trying to build a house of beyond a reasonable doubt, and the defense wants to tear their house down or burn it down, make it scorched. All right. Now, let's move on to Amy Rocha, who is Lacey's half-sister. And Rick D'Estacio is doing the direct examination, and Mark Garagos is doing the cross. And on direct examination, Amy provided some background on the family information and told about the first time she met Scott. She identified the floor plan for Scott and Lacey's home to be correct, right? She needs somebody to establish that.
If people are dieting now more than ever before, why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that doesn't turn into fat when you consume it. Instead, it turns into a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body.
So getting more MCTs in your diet is like flipping a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which flushes out excess fat and calories. And Dr. Gundry has created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it comes in a tasty drink form. It actually tastes good. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized.
So if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/RLRC and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. And again, that's GundryMD.com/RLRC.
Awesome.
All right, good deal.
Medical Mutual wants to remind you it's almost time for Medicare's annual enrollment period. As a trusted health insurer for more than 90 years, Medical Mutual is here to help you find better Medicare benefits. Be confident you're getting the most from your Medicare Advantage plan. Schedule your free Medicare plan review today at medmutual.com/review. Medical Mutual, Ohio's hometown Medicare insurer.
And they listed that as People's Exhibit 12. Now, she identified the different areas of Salon, and that was entered as People's Exhibit 3. That would have been where Lacey got a haircut, et cetera. Got her nails done. Amy told about Lacey and Scott's visit to the salon on the 23rd and the Vela Farms purchase for Grandfather Rocha and Scott's volunteering to pick it up the next day. She described in detail what Lacey was wearing. Capri-length, cream-colored pants in a stretchy cotton fabric, a black jacket that was longer than her blouse, and a cream-colored scarf. Now, before Amy cut Scott's hair that day, she showed Lacey how to do a fun flip. Now, Garagos on cross-examination started with a few questions about Lacey's pants and asking Amy to specifically admit the pants found on Lacey were not the pants she wore to Salon. So in her testimony goes into Monday, June 7th, they call her back up. And again, Rick is doing the direct and Mark is doing the cross. And on cross, Garagos went into a lot of detail about the inheritance from Roach's grandparents. And the lion's share of the grandmother's jewelry was given to Lacey. And according to Garagos, it's valued between $50,000 and $100,000. And Amy said she had no idea what the jewelry was valued at, right? She's not a juror. That's the right word. She and Lacey went through the jewelry and decided what would be sold, and Lacey was in charge of the sales. Now, some items were offered on eBay, and others were sold to pawn shops. In addition, Amy, Lacey, and Brent would be equally splitting the proceeds from the sale of the grandfather's house and also one half of the Rocha estate. Now, Amy said Lacey was aware she wouldn't receive the bulk of their inheritance until she reached the age of 30. Amy was asked by Modesto PD to go to the Covina home on February 18th to see if she could find the clothes Lacey was wearing on December 23rd. She said she was able to pick out the entire outfit. And after Lacey's body was found, she was asked to look at three pictures and pick out the pants that Lacey was wearing on the 23rd. And one of the pictures was the pants style that Lacey was found in. And Amy said, definitely not to two pictures, including the pants style Lacey was found in, right? So he's trying to, I think Gargos is trying to say, you know, oh, it's not like what she was found in. The police got it wrong again. So Gargos is done with it, right? Well, the prosecution gets what we call redirect, where they get up to ask the witness some questions that would clarify the things that they said. Says Rick D'Estacio, and on redirect, he pointed out that Amy has always been certain of the length and color of pants Lacey was wearing, which was the same length and color as the pants Lacey was found in. He also asked Amy if Scott had ever asked her to dye his hair or she had ever known him to have dyed hair. And she said no to both questions. What are we doing here, y'all? Remember when he got arrested, his hair was dyed. And on recross, Gargos gets back up because he wants to take that away. And he countered with a review of Amy rejecting the pants Lacey was found in as the pants she was wearing on the 23rd. He also asked Amy if hair that has been lightened would bleach out to an orange blonde color from exposure to chlorine in a swimming pool. And I remember I called bullshit on this, and Scott said, oh, yeah, and then my hair got dyed because I was swimming in a pool with a lot of chlorine. That's fucking stupid. Anyway, but when you're on the stand, you have to say the truth. And she said hair that was possible could change colors in chlorine. It's chemically possible, but she had never seen it. And Gargo asked her if she was ever asked by Modesto PD to examine Scott's hair after the arrest. She said no. And Amy also revealed that on December 23rd, it was Scott that asked her to come over to their house for pizza that night. Let's go to Lacey's mom, who gets called, y'all, Miss Sharon. And it's typical that you want to put the human face on your victim. And I've seen this 1,000 times. The defense sometimes will, yeah, you know, I saw it in Courtney Coco's trials. It was one of the only times I've ever seen the defense try to tear into the victim's mother, really. And that was a fuck up on his part. But let me just tell you what Miss Sharon said. So basically, she reviewed Lacey's birth, you know, when she was born, how it was, and her growing up years, and when she met Scott. And she said after Lacey's marriage, they moved to Modesto, talked about the purchase of their home. And this, Rick's asking these questions, y'all. And Sharon painted a picture of a very close relationship with Lacey, telling Sharon about anything of importance, right? Confiding in her mom. She said that she saw nothing in Scott and Lacey's relationship prior to December the 24th to cause her to think they were not happily married. As far as Sharon knew, Lacey would enter the park at the Covina entrance, walk to the tennis courts, and then return. Sharon reviewed the information she had about Lacey getting sick while walking. And the last time Lacey talked about walking was in conjunction with the second incident in late October or early November. And Lacey never told her She had changed the route she walked in the park. She said Lacey did not want to go to Disneyland because her feet were swollen and she was tired and it would be too much walking. So that ties back in, y'all, that her friends that live across the street said she quit walking because of the pregnancy. But remember, later on, you got all these motherfuckers they didn't interview that said they saw her. But anyway, we'll get to it. Scores. On the 24th, December 24th, Sharon, Lacey's mom, went to the movies with a Sandy Ricard, and they didn't invite Lacey, assuming she would be too uncomfortable, right? She's big preggo, y'all. Sharon returned home about 3 or 3:30 and then asked Ron to call Lacey to bring whipping cream, okay? Scott called her just after 5:15 p.m. to ask if Lacey was there and said Lacey was missing. She related the events of that night, particularly not being able to get Scott's attention in the park. This is when everybody's there looking for Lacey. And later at the house, Sharon trying to control Scott, and he kept moving away from her. She also said Lacey told her Scott had to meet with his boss in San Francisco on December the 14th, and that is why he couldn't attend the Christmas party with her. Well, laying it down, right? We all know where he was. He was laying up with Amber Fry. As part of the testimony, Rick DeSasso played the conversation Sharon taped between herself and Scott on February the 13th. This is months after Lacey and Connors disappeared. She said previously Scott had avoided talking to her and specifically noted December 28th and January 1st. She related details of a family dinner on January 14th when she asked Scott what he used to fish for sturgeon, right? That's what he said. Then what he told the cops, oh yeah, after, I don't know what I was fishing for, oh, I was fishing for sturgeon. So she's, I'm sure Mama Baron has looked it up, right? And said, hey, what do you use to fish for sturgeon, Scott? And he didn't answer it, okay? Finally, when Sharon was notified on April 15th that the bodies had been found, she left a message for Scott to return home immediately. She said he never even returned her phone call, right? He already fucking knew. So Gargos gets up on cross. Now, this is, you don't want to really get into a victim's mom's ass, right? Because you're going to lose, if you have any respect from the jury, you might lose it. But on cross, Gargos suggested Lacey was so long in accepting the invitation to Sharon's Christmas Eve dinner because she was having personal problems with someone on the guest list. Now, Sharon said it was because she had not yet purchased gifts for everyone. Gargos reviewed what Sharon and Ron told Detective Grogan on January 29th about Lacey's normal routine, and walking McKenzie was included in that. Lacey described as an independent person who would do what she wanted, and this is what Sharon said. Lacey did not tell her she went walking while, I guess, at Carmel, California, only that she went shopping with Jackie and she was tired. Sharon said the neighborhood project Lacey was involved in was the Encina project, not the problem with the homeless coming out of the park and going down Covina on their way to the mission. She said she had no knowledge of any involvement on Lacey's part in the homeless problem. Again, Gargos is trying to say, maybe she got taken by a homeless person. Sharon didn't remember Detective Brocchini telling them on the night of the 24th when he said the family should go home, that Scott should not go to her house after he finished with Detective Brocchini because someone should be at home in case a call came in. Well, that kind of makes sense. Somebody should be there in case Lacey, maybe it's a ransom call. Maybe Lacey is drunk in a bar, right? But anyway, they got phones, right? They got cell phones. But Sharon said Scott called her mom and never was angry with Lacey, even when others thought he should have been. See, you want to get up there and you want to tell the truth. Even if you're saying damning things about him, you don't want to lie about shit like this because it could come back to bite you in the ass and it makes you believable to the jury. And on redirect, Sharon said that she had known prior to December 24, which she found out later, she would absolutely have had a different opinion of Scott and that y'all is going to be the affair with Amber Fry and all that. On recross, Gargos took the opportunity to show the picture of Lacey in Scott's blue pajamas. And then there was a second redirect and a second recross. And it was all focused on whether or not Lacey had any involvement with a homeless problem. And, you know, I get trying to throw up a bunch of different things and see if they stick. And you got to do that. If you can get one juror to have some doubt in their mind and, it, you know, they hadn't got to the burger shit yet and all the people that saw her walking, but they're saying there was a homeless problem where Lacey walked them. She was involved in the helping them or whatever. And it could have been, they're implying it could have been one of them that took her and little baby Connor. And y'all, now I'm going to stop this episode. Love and appreciate each and every one of y'all. Stay with me. I've got everything and I'm going to tell you what's tore up as it goes. I've got everything. I know it's long, but man, it's just a fascinating story and it's so, so scorched. And again, check out my TikTok, the Real Life Real Crime Community app and all that good podcaster shit I'm supposed to say. Yeah, go to follow me on TikTok and check out the shit that these people are sending me. Fire. I'm wearing a pair of somewhat like their camouflage shiner box shorts that Jake Donaldson sent me with along with a bunch of other stuff he sent me from the brewery in Texas. And I appreciate that. I'm wearing them right now, bro. They're comfortable as hell. And just anyway, love and appreciate each and every one of y'all. LOPA, Louisiana Organ Procurement Agency. You know, it's my jam. You don't have to be a lifer from Louisiana to sign up to be an organ donor. You could be a lifer from, let me pick something, Virginia. You could be a lifer from Virginia. Go to LOPA.org, take 2 minutes, fill out the questionnaire, become a hero, give the gift of sight and life and all the great shit that they do. Remember, they're a nonprofit and they save lives every day. And I'm Woody Overton, your host of Real Life, Real Crime, the podcast. And until next time, or ever, don't let me catch you down on Murder Bayou. Peace.
You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have a right to an attorney prior to or during any questioning. If you can't afford one, the court will appoint one for you. Do you understand your rights?